addressing oppositional behavior in children effectively. I would start by saying that we all, as parents, address oppositional behavior in our children. You're hit with it. Your kids don't want to do what you're asking them to do. And so you have to address it. And so this is not about whether one should address oppositional behavior, and this is not about strictly the benefits of addressing oppositional behavior. There's a hand there going around back. I actually don't have any more up here. What this is about is addressing oppositional behavior effectively. What's effective? In a strict behavioral term, effectively means you get them to stop. We want to address the behavior in a way that will get them to stop doing whatever it is that they're doing. Now, it's very important that we understand that oppositional behavior takes very different forms at different ages. Okay. What we're going to describe as oppositional for a 3-year-old is incredibly different than oppositional for a 13-year-old or for a 7-year-old, both in terms of what the behavior is, but also the severity of the behavior. Regardless, though, of what we're talking about, regardless of how severe the oppositional behavior is, and we take a much stricter view as the kids get older, we need to, and it's incumbent upon us, and it's to the benefit of us and our children, that we address and train them, we're training them in how we're going to respond and what's expected of them from a very early age. Even if oppositional for a 2-year-old is they don't stay still while you're changing their diaper. Right? Not a huge deal. We're much bigger than them and we can sort of hold them down. I did that this morning with my son. But we train them from day one. If anybody who just came in didn't get handouts, there's handouts up in the front. Okay. So let's take a look. I think that what we're talking about here, if we look at slide 2 on the first page, is this concept of behavior management. When we're talking about oppositional behavior and changing and addressing oppositional behavior, what we're talking about is how do we make that behavior change? What do we do that effectively will stop that behavior? Now, in that bottom bubble there where it says requirements, there are 3 things that must happen in order to effectively change a child's behavior at any age. At any age. Number one, and we're going to talk about each of these. Number one is consistency. And when I say consistency, we'll address it towards the end of the talk, but when I say consistency, we're talking about 2 types of consistency. Right? Consistency number one is that you always respond to them basically the same way. That when your child says no, they're not going to eat their dinner tonight, you have a response, whatever that response may be. And that the next time the kid says it, you have the same response. You don't let it go. I'm not going to bed tonight. I don't want to go to bed. That you have the response to that. And that the next time you have that response. So there's response across time, which is crucial. And I think that one of the major difficulties that comes through my office is when parents say, yeah, but I was too tired this time. Or it had been, I'd had enough and I just couldn't do it anymore. And what happens is, for very good reason, we often falter in our consistency with which we respond to our kids. So, number one is they have to know, why is it important to be consistent? Because your child needs to be able to predict what's going to happen. It's better for them to be able to predict, well, if I do this, I know what's going to happen. But it's also only fair to them. So that they know that when this happens, there's a result and there's a consequence. Number two is that the consequence has to be effective. And when I talk about effective consequence, that's a piece that you could talk about much more than I can. And for that reason, I'm not going to be focusing tremendously on that part of it. Effective consequences is something that is subjectively rewarding or punishing for that child. Reinforcing or punishing for that child. You have to know your children. And again, we can sit here and we can brainstorm together and I can share with you some of the things that I've done for kids at different levels. But you know your household and you know your children. Can we close that just a little bit? Just a little, don't do that. Okay. Oh, is it? Well, maybe back there. Can we open the window back there a little bit? the consequence has to be meaningful to that child. For that reason, if your child has no interest in having you read to them in bed at night, your child doesn't do anything for them, then telling them, go to bed or I'm not going to read to you in bed, is obviously a useless consequence. It doesn't mean anything to that child. Okay? So, on the other hand, if for your child, going outside and tossing the ball around with them is like one of their joys, then that becomes a very effective consequence. So effective consequences are subjectively effective, subjectively rewarding or punishing, which is why you can't give a blanket idea of what's a good consequence or what's a good reward or punishment. And the last piece down there, that bullet, is developmentally meaningful. It has, and this is where we're going to spend most of our time today, is that your consequence must be developmentally meaningful. Kids at different ages think differently. The research over and over and over again demonstrates that a two-year-old understands his or her world incredibly differently than a five-year-old or a nine-year-old or a 15-year-old. They understand what they're looking at. They learn differently. For instance, on a very academic level, my basis in the school psychology is, you know, I don't know if any of you are educators here. Okay, any of you are educators know that we have, no matter what you're teaching, there's a concept of curriculum, and the curriculum grows as kids get older. Math is a great example. Why do we teach kids addition before subtraction? Before, and basic math concepts before we get to algebra and higher concepts? Because the young child understands the concept of addition, but doesn't grasp the concept of subtraction. It doesn't make sense to them. The idea of taking something away is developmentally impossible for them to conceive. And so we don't teach them subtraction right away. Addition has to come first because developmentally, that's what they understand younger. It's the same thing. They're much more concrete when they're younger. They're much more abstract when they're older. They're able to think about things that aren't in front of them when they're older. Whether that's math, because algebra and trigonometry and all those things are much more sophisticated, or whether you're talking about ways of addressing with consequences. A five-year-old can't deal with, and we're going to get into this in more detail, talking about in 3 days from, if you don't do this now, in 3 days from now, you're not going to go to Savta's house. You're not going to go to Zadie's house. That's 3 days from now. There's no concept. So they developmentally can't grasp that concept, whereas your teenager can. And so the question is, how do I come up with a consequence that I can deliver consistently, right? So we stay away from, you won't go with your friends for 3 weeks if you do this now, because am I going to be able to keep that up for 3 weeks, keeping my kid away from his friends? Consistently, you have to be able to come up with something that is subjectively meaningful to your child, and then you want to come up with something that makes sense to them at their age. So let's look at that slide as a whole. Here's how behavior management works. In this way, I shudder to say it, but in this way, our children are very much like lab rats. Behavior management works. Behavior management is the way that those scientists got rats to figure out in the maze, or got the pigeons to push on a button so that they got a little pill, a little treat, right? That's what we're doing with our kids. Why? Because it's almost guaranteed to work as long as it's done right in terms of changing behavior. So let's look at what happens. In this situation, it could be anything. The one on the slide is wanting to watch a late-night TV show. Another one could be wanting to listen to the baseball game. Right, the kids who are really interested in sports like to listen on the radio to the baseball game. Another one could be that they want to go over their friend's house, but it's a school night and it's going to be late. Any number of these situations. It doesn't make a difference what the situation is, but it's a situation. Now, the behavior is what they're going to do in order to get what they want. So, your daughter goes over to a friend's house, and she's supposed to come back, but she doesn't want to come back, so she doesn't call you. She doesn't answer her cell phone if she has a cell phone. She doesn't call back. She doesn't tell you she went to the third person's house. She's not going to tell you where she is. because she doesn't want to have to come back. That's her behavior. The child who wants to listen to the baseball game on the radio or watch it on the TV and stay up late to do that, that child is going to stay up late in order to do it. Right? So that child is going to, I've had many kids who say, yeah, I kept the radio underneath the blanket with me and I listened to the game till it was over at 11 o'clock at night. So you have what you want, you have their situation, and then you have the behavior. Now, what's going to determine whether that child does that again or not? That's in your hands. It's okay. Take a look at the far right side of this chart. Consequence I use very specifically. A consequence is not a punishment. A consequence is a natural result of the action. And it's very, very important when we talk about guiding our children that we talk about... People need it. When we talk about guiding our children, it's very important that what we're talking about is a consequence. And we tell our children that we're purposefully calling it a consequence. I'm not here to punish you. The action is going to follow from what you did. Let me give you an example. The child stays up late. Okay? The child stays up late and gets away with it. They had their radio under the blanket. They listen to the baseball game. They get up the next morning. They go to school. You never knew about it. Chances are that kid says, I got away with it. And the next game, they're going to do the same thing. They're going to repeat the behavior. Why? Because they got away with it. On the other hand, you walk in the room, you see that there, you hear something as you're walking past their bedroom at night, you go in, you look on, the kid's listening to the thing, and you have some response to that. A consequence that you take away the radio. They had the radio when they weren't supposed to have it. The natural consequence is you lose the right to have the radio. Well, now the kid got punished. That's called a punishment. So that the chances are the child will not repeat the action. Because there was a problem. There was a consequence to that. There was a negative consequence. If you walk by and hear the radio and say, what are you doing? And the kid says, I'm listening to the game. And you say, you're not allowed to do that. Turn it off right now. And you walk into your room. And the kid finishes listening to the radio. Then once again, it worked. They got away with it. So the construct here is, they have a behavior that they do. If you respond in a way that is punishing, when we talk about reinforcements and punishments as consequences, reinforcements are things that make the behavior happen again, and punishments are things that make the behavior stop. So, if what your response to them is a reinforcer, either nothing really happens, they get away with it, everything's fine, then chances are the behavior will happen again. The pigeon that pushes on a pedal and gets a treat, they're going to push that pedal again, and again, and again, and again, and again. Okay? If, on the other hand, the kid got busted, you took the radio away, they don't get the radio anymore, the next night they don't get it, or you can't go to your friend's house the next time you want to go because you've lost the privilege by not keeping up, not being honest and being back when you needed to be, then there's a punishment. And so it reduces the chance, the probability, that the child's going to do the same thing again. Okay? All of this is dependent on our three bullets, that you do it every time, that it is meaningful, that losing the radio is meaningful, that not going to her friend's house is meaningful, and lastly, that it is developmentally meaningful, that it makes sense to them. So, let's look at the last part first. How do we make something developmentally meaningful? It's on the back of that page, I believe. I asked you about the ages of your kids, and divided them into three rough groups. The research, the two names that you see at the top, Jean Piaget and Lawrence Kohlberg, are developmental psychologists. Anybody in education has heard their names. Anybody in education, anyone who took a college psych class has heard their names. Anyone who took an AP psych class has heard their names. They're very, very popular guys. Jean Piaget died about 20, 25 years ago. Lawrence Kohlberg died more recently. their approach said that what we were saying before, that kids grow up, and as they grow, they change the way they think. And because they change the way they think, in fact, not only do they change the way they think about things and understand things, but they also change the way they conceive of right and wrong. What makes an action right and what makes an action wrong. And understanding this piece about children allows us to develop consequences to deal with that oppositional behavior in a much more effective way. So let's take a look at this K to 2, the young children. Now, the reason I did grades and not ages is actually very specific. Because the grades allow, my point is that there's some variability. Nothing is hard and set in stone. Kids develop at different speeds. So this is to give us a general idea of the ages at which we're going to see these shifts in thought. But any of your children, you're going to be able to say, yes, my children thinks just like that, or my child actually thinks a little bit below or above what you're describing here. The concept, though, doesn't change of figuring out where they're at. But let's take a look at how these work. Grades K to 2 are real little ones. They're real adorable little ones. Most of the time.
Are you going to talk about below K or no?
We can talk about below K, what I have found in below K children. Oppositional behavior is, we're not training them for the future so much with below K. When I say below K, again, I'm talking about till about 2 years old. Okay, kindergarten agreed. Kindergarten is really about five, right? Up until about age four, it's very similar. Well, how can I do this? Ages one and two, let's push off to the side. Okay? Ages one and two is about just keeping them safe. Right? And anything that we can't deem 1 and 2 year olds as being oppositional. 1 and 2 year olds are just a bundle of energy, and they're just going off, and that's not oppositional. 3 and 4 year olds, in many ways, are similar to the K to two in terms of what they understand. However, the specifics of the consequences are usually even more simplistic than our K to 2 year olds. And I'll give you a couple of examples while we're doing it. But let's look at the K to two. By K to two, again, I would easily say it's 4 years old and up. Three is a little harder. Number one, they're very egocentric. And egocentric is not a value statement here. Egocentric is a fact. They think about themselves. In fact, says the developmental theory, they don't have the ability to really think about somebody else. And we've seen that in a number of experiments, but in a number of situations. I once had a parent say to me in this type of a discussion, that's not true. And I said, okay, how do you know that's not true? Well, my child, who is 6 years old, has a 3-year-old brother. And she will make sure that he has something to eat before she eats something. So what she was saying there is, see, she understands that her little brother doesn't have food to eat. And that ability is counter to this concept. This concept of egocentricity says, I understand things from my perspective, but if you say, how would somebody else feel? I can't answer the question. She was saying it's not true because my child's able to understand that the younger sibling, in fact, is hungry and needs food. To which I argued that that's not quite what's happening. This is much more of a statement about you as a parent than about your child. Your child knows that if they do this, they're going to get a good girl. That was really good work. Thank you so much. So what are they doing it for? Not out of some beneficent, altruism. They're doing it because the reward that they're going to get, and we're going to talk about how that affects right and wrong, okay? So they're preoccupied with me, and again, it's not a value judgment, it's how they think. We hope that as we get older, we jump out of this stage. Many people have trouble, but our goal is to move on. They're also incredibly concrete. They're incredibly concrete. They need to see it, hear it, feel it for it to exist. It needs to be here and now. And you will be much more effective if your consequences are things that they can see, feel, or hear right now. And if it's something for later in the future, we're going to have a lot of trouble because they don't get it. We're going to look at some examples, but take a look. So how do these kids decide and understand what's right and wrong? And here's the key. Here's the key. How do they understand what's right and wrong? Something is right, okay? If the immediate if the consequence to the action is immediate and sensory. If I do something and the immediate consequence is right away I get something that I don't like, then by definition what I just did was wrong. On the other hand, if I do something and the result of that right away is something that I like, then I just did something right. And that's the entire definition for them of right and wrong. So, it's the danger of putting all of our coats in the back. You know what? Here, turn the page. I'm just watching the clock. Turn the page. Let's look at some examples. You hit your little brother. Go to timeout. Assuming we're using timeout effectively, and again, the consequences have to be effective, but assuming you're using it effectively, what happens? You hit your little brother right away. I pick you up and I put you in timeout. Now, my older daughter, I always had to put in timeout. I had to pick her up, go to timeout. No, and she'd fall to the floor and I'd have to go. Now we have a problem because my son, I have a two-year-old also at home, and he goes and hits his sister, his older sister. And then they said, Amitai, what did you do? I hit Maya. I'm going to timeout. And he goes and marches off to timeout. And then I don't hear from him for like 2 or 3 minutes, and he's sort of sitting there, you know, twiddling his thumbs. The question becomes, is timeout really effective for him if he wants to go do it? But if it is something, that goes back to our, is it subjectively rewarding or punishing? But assuming that it is subjectively punishing, then that timeout has to be immediate, and it's a removal from what they want to do. That is an effective consequence, a developmentally appropriate effective consequence. Eat most of what's on your plate and you will get dessert. It's right here, it's right now. Do you want something? Yes. Well, eat most of what's on your plate. Everybody has their opinions about what types of food the kids have to eat and how much they have to eat. You want to say, eat most of what's on your plate and you get dessert. Again, therefore, the child learns. The child learns that if they eat the dinner and they get dessert, then eating dinner must have been the right thing to do. And that's how they learn it. First go to the bathroom, then we can go outside and play. Don't go to the bathroom, we're not going anywhere. Again, what do they want? They want to go outside. That's something that they're eager for. So if you take that away from them, you don't even have to take it away. What you're doing is you're making it a contingency. Then going to the bathroom when they're told, go to the bathroom, becomes the definition of what's right. If you don't go to the bathroom, then you're punished. You don't get to go outside. So not going to the bathroom is wrong. That's how they're learning. It's very simple. It's very straightforward. Brush your teeth now or no book tonight. Again, I was listening to a speaker once who said that they love reading books to their children. They love getting into bed at night with their child and reading. So this was really tough for them because then it's self-punishing. So there are lots of different approaches. For this particular person, I suggested when we were talking about it, every night you get one book, right? Because that's what I need as a parent. I'll read you a book. If you want extra books, you got to brush your teeth. Right, it's the extra bonus, and this way you can keep it up. But it actually speaks to a very important issue. It speaks to the issue of, can I consistently enforce this? If it kills me to not read my child a book, then I'm going to look for ways to weasel out of this. You know, come on, I'll brush your teeth with you, I'll stand with you, come on, I'll give you one more chance. So that's not helpful, ultimately, because your child doesn't learn. The child learns that they can manipulate, so you don't want to do that. Again, within this, we're seeing this concept of they understand their world of right and wrong based exclusively on what they get or don't get. That's how they understand it. You know, again, for those of you who are educators of young, young children, we teach sharing, the concept of sharing, in a number of different ways. Now, we like to prime our kids and to try to teach them that sharing is, again, this wonderful thing that we do, because when we share, we give something to somebody who doesn't have it, who wants to have an opportunity. That's much harder for them to get. And for that reason, we may include that, but almost exclusively, we tell our kids, whether you're an educator or you're a parent, share with him, because then he'll share with you. Right? If you want somebody to share with you, then you need to share with them. That's back to this very concrete. Right? What makes it good to share? We know that the moral value of sharing is a lot more sophisticated than just getting it back. But this is what we teach our children. So it's being on that level of immediate sensory. What's going to go along with all of these, and that you have to remember, is that the other, and this is probably the hardest part of all of it, is being calm when all of this is happening. What's interesting is parents will tell me that they get into these horrible knockdown, drag-out fights with their children. I mean, it gets nasty. And it's all the time, and they don't like it, and it's just miserable, and they're fighting, and it's such a terrible relationship they have. And it starts even this young. Bedtime with my 4-year-old is just horrible. I can't get it done, they say. What I'll often ask them is, what are the positive experiences like with your child? Because very often what happens is our negative experiences are a lot of yelling and screaming and anger. And our positive experiences are incredibly calm. Thank you, good job, you know, if we even say that. Right? My kid comes home and says, your young child comes home and turns to you. I had this experience. I remember when I had this with my daughter, and she came home from school and said, Daddy, what bracha do I say on this? So, like, that was the first time she asked me, right? And it was so exciting. Now, if I said, you make a mezonos, now move on, you know, then, or let's say the bracha together, you say the mezonos and whatever. What happens is, kids crave the energy of the relationship. Kids go for whatever is high energy. And if what's high energy is the negative, then they will start doing wrong so that they can get that intense interaction from us. So we actually want to flip it. And this is entirely counterintuitive to life. But this is crucial whether you're dealing with your K or your 8th grader or your 10th grader. Is that it's the positive that you want to make a big deal about. Everything has a qualification. The psychologists all talk about, you know, when your kid brings home a picture of a yellow blob and you say, oh, that's a beautiful sun. I've never seen a sun so beautiful. It's incredible. They say that, you know what? Kids can tell when you're sort of overdoing it. But when your kid says thank you without you asking, and it's thank you, Abba, did you hear that she just said thank you? This is so wonderful. I love it when you say thank you. That's actually really important. And that when the child does this and you have to say, go to the bathroom or we're not going out to play. I don't want to go to the bathroom. Then we're not going to go play. And you walk away. Then you've reduced the intensity of the interaction. And that's crucial, crucial to getting through to them. Okay, let's move on to grades 3 to 8. So we're moving now. What's going to happen is, as we move up, we're going to incorporate a new element based on their developmental abilities, based on what they're able to conceive and think about. So we're not going to take away, number one, of making it sensory, making it meaningful, but we're going to add a new element to it. Who are these 3 to 8-year-olds? These 3 to 8-year-olds have a 3 to 8th grade, I apologize, thank you for catching me, have a growing social understanding. They're now able to take the perspective of others. They care about what other people think. So this is something that young kids can't do, we argue, developmentally. They're unable to take the other's perspective in any way that approaches what a 3rd to 8th grader is able to do. So now you're able to say, what would somebody else think? Beginning of abstract thinking. Now they're also starting to be able to consider things that aren't in front of them. Okay? If you hit your brother, what am I going to do? Well, that hasn't happened yet. But they're able to start considering that. Okay. So now they're able to, A, predict a little bit, and B, they have the ability to start getting into somebody else's head. You know, anybody who does reading with their children, the young kids, you read a story, and then you ask them a question. Right? So you can read any of these stories and say, you know, I was reading one of these Tanakh stories to my child, and I said, so, you know, what did, we were doing Yosef, right? So, what was Yosef's coat like? Well, lots of colors. And where did his brothers throw Yosef? Threw him in a pit. Now, the next step is the inferential question. That was a recall question. The young kids can do the recall question. You ask the young child, right, why do you think that Yosef's brothers threw him in a pit? Well, that's a much harder question. Because then you have to make some inferences about something that's not right on the page. Unless it's it. Yosef's brothers were angry at him and they threw him in the pit. But if it's inference, the child was crying, that so-and-so stole this child's ball and the child was crying. Why was the child crying? So they'll say, because they stole the ball. But what made them cry? The younger kids can't answer that as sophisticated as these older kids can. So it's the ability to start thinking in somebody else's head. Let's go back to the right or wrong. So what is right or wrong for these kids? Now we're a little bit more sophisticated. How do they judge whether something is right or wrong? It's primarily based on the approval of others. The wonderful part is when it's based on the approval of us, of their parents. What happens is that as these kids grow and develop, it goes, the parental approval starts off being very important, and then it starts to shift, and peer approval becomes more important than parental approval. And the reason for that is actually very, very, it makes a lot of sense. It's very developmental. These kids, when they start growing up, they're in their house, they're with you, mom and dad are like know-it-alls, they can answer any question, they can fix any problem I have, right? And mom and dad are the best. You know, there's nothing better. And then what happens is they start to develop their own identity. They start to try to sort of ask, who am I? What do I like? What don't I like? What's important to me? What's not important to me? And they look around them. And their friends are much more similar to them than their parents. They're the same size as them. They have the same interests as them. Right? They go to school with them. They talk the same way. Well, what's going to happen is these children are going to start to shift towards that which is familiar to them and common to them, and that's their peers. So that shift as they get older happens as it moves from parent approval and teacher approval to peer approval. The class clown is the perfect example. The class clown is the kid who says, I don't really care anymore if the teacher's going to get angry at me. What I want are the laughs, because the laughs are peer approval. So that's what happens as they start to get into this age group. So how do we deal with this? Turn the page, and we'll look at some examples of this. Now, what we're doing here is you're going to see elements of the first, but you're adding in something in the second. It will make me very sad to go to the park without you, but I will unless you get your coat on immediately. Absolutely, this has to be in a case where you can do that, right? You can't leave your third grader at home by themselves while you take the other siblings out to the park. But that being said, what you're doing here is you're adding in this element. You're still saying, you got to put on your coat or I'm leaving you at home. Right? But what you're doing is you're adding in the part that's going to make you very upset. That very upset for the younger kids is actually quite effective.
Don't kids at this age know that you're not really going to go to the park without them? They're like, oh, yeah, I'm going to call you.
Oh, that all depends on you. Because are you going to go to the park? Because don't use this if you're not going to go to the park without them.
Oh, okay.
So if you're home, your spouse is off at work or off running errands, and you're home with the five kids, right? You want to get them out of the house. So you're going to go walk the three blocks to the park, and your second grader says, I'm not putting on my coat. Well, I'm going to leave you here, but you know you're not going to. What I often do, though, is I tell parents, you know what you can do then? Walk them all to the park, and the kid sits with you on the bench. That's much more realistic. I had a parent who basically said that to Dr. Bailey. You're giving these great examples. Wonderful examples in a perfect world. But what happens when I've got five kids with me at home and I can't leave one at home? So you have to deal with what the reality is. But the concept doesn't change. The concept is you got to be creative, but you're saying is, I don't want you to have to lose going, being able to play on the jungle gym, and it makes me sad to do it, but you're going to have to sit here with me. You're adding in this element. If you don't go to sleep, you'll not be able to go with your friends tomorrow. They're going to be very disappointed without you. It's starting to shift. Your friends are going to look around and you're not going to be with them. Right? What's it going to be like when they're going and talking about stuff when they get to school and you don't know what they're talking about because you weren't with them? That's the peer approval. That's being joined with them. So you have to point that out to your kid, right? Because your child, whether they know it or not, is thinking like that. That's important to them. So go to sleep now or you're not going. And I'm drawing that line. That's the immediate. That said, it's your friends who are going to be disappointed in this. Yes?
Does the consequence have to be related to the behavior of the
so happy you asked that question.
One,
yes.
It is related, but in the second one, it's not. Remember, in the first one, like, if you don't say you're not going to park, those other going to park. But in the second one, like, they feel your friends related, then you're going to sleep. So, because I've always wrapped my brain to think that they have to be some connection.
The answer is that it absolutely has to be connected. If you, especially as the kids get older. Especially. But I say, my personal view is that it always does. I'll show you how I connect this in a second. I'll tell you what I tell my children. But, or my parents who are telling the children. But it absolutely has to be connected. And that's a very important point. And it's, you'll see it when we get to the older kids. Because if it doesn't make sense, then they get to dismiss you as an evil, rotten, angry parent. Because you've lost it. She's crazy. He's blown his top. What is he talking about? I don't eat my dinner, and so then I'm not gonna be able to go out with my friends for the next week and a half. What's the? When you can connect it, then you go back to being able to calmly make it a consequence that follows. So it's more obvious in the first one. What I would say to this one is, if you don't go to sleep, right, then you're gonna. I know that you need sleep because you're gonna be tired without it. You need to sleep in order to get your energy back. Going with your friends uses up energy. So if you're not going to sleep now, you are not getting to expend that energy tomorrow. And that's it. So it's up, absolutely. You have to believe in the connection. You have to make the connection. And it has to work for you. The more you can overtly and clearly connect it, the better off you're going to be. I'll come to you in just a moment. Because I just want to make sure we do get to do this. If you help your mom set the table, we can send a note to your teacher telling her what you did. That's, again, some of the younger kids. But I've actually seen this work with some fourth, fifth graders. Where the fifth graders want their teacher's approval. The mora, the mitzvah notes. The mitzvah notes are all about that. Right? Telling your teacher so that you get a mitzvah note at school is all about teacher approval. It's also about saving them up and getting a reward when you have enough mitzvah notes for those that work that way. But it's about teacher approval. So if you help mom set the table, then you're doing something that is good. And so your teacher will find out about it and be able to praise you, and she'll be proud of you. That becomes very important. So what made it right? The fact that there was teacher approval, that I got the note, etc. So right and wrong here is based on the concept that they're looking for and they're seeking approval. You don't take away the consequence. And if the consequence can be tied to approval, like going out with your friends, then that's great. But you're picking something that's based on, see now that one, that kid crying over there.
How about a good positive consequence for homework? I'm just sure that so many people have that.
We'll ask everybody else that question. But what
that's
was it?
So funny, that was my question. What about a child that never wants to do homework since they don't care if they fail, they don't care if they don't get a good grade, they don't care if the teacher yells at them, they could not care less.
Okay. Do you recognize the cry?
I think so.
Okay. Homework is a very unique issue. It's unique because it's unique and it's not unique. It's unique in that we are often more invested in our children doing homework than our children are. For any number of reasons. But we're more invested, which actually puts us at a real disadvantage. Because we start getting hysterical and scrambling to try to get our kids to do stuff. It's not unique in that the same format still follows. So, the first question is, what is an effective consequence to not doing homework? What is something that will touch your child, that will be meaningful to your child? I ask you, this is the part that's much harder for me. I do this in my practice when I'm sitting with the parents and the child and we're talking to that child. What have you ever done that's actually motivated your child to do homework when they didn't want to do it?
But you said it has to be related, so what's related?
Well, first, find something that's meaningful.
What? You're going to fail. He says, I don't care.
Yofi, there's
approval.
Much more than that.
He
yes, in the back.
He doesn't care about teacher approval.
I would say homework is like me going for your job as a child, and you want to do the extras, like basketball or dancing or whatever.
So I work in order to make money so that I can then do stuff. right? That I can either go on a vacation or buy you toys, which makes me so happy. Anything, right? If you want to do the things that you want to do, you've got to get your obligations out of the way first. So you have to know what your child wants to do. And any parent who says to me, my kid doesn't want to do anything, my kid will sit in their room like this and doesn't care, they're wrong. It's untrue.
But you said it has to be pretty immediate, especially for a younger child.
But for the younger child, absolutely. But here's where it still ties together. It still ties together. Is the overarching concept that you're presenting to your child is you have to get through your obligations if you want to do whatever it is that you want to do. So on a given night, what do your children do? Do they get any time for themselves?
After their homework, they go to bed.
So now I'd like to, what I would do is I would say,
you could stay up a little bit.
Let's flip it. Exactly. Exactly. You go get a book that you want to read. You go get a little game system that if you get to have one that you want to play. Or I'll sit and read you a story, or you can play any of those things if you want. So, well, we can talk about why it's not working. Yes. True. You don't know. And that's, look, I don't know because I'm standing up here for 45 minutes, right? But there could be any number of things that are going on for the child and in terms of the construct of the house. What I would like to do is I do want to get to the adolescents because you're all going to have adolescents if you don't have them now. And there's a real qualitative difference. Two? I was told 5, 3 minutes ago. Oh, that is 2. Okay. That's why. I don't do math. I do this. Okay. Number 1, they are incredibly abstract thinkers. They can reason and understand things that are not here now. They can talk about the future. You can talk with your older teenager about something that hasn't happened and isn't going to happen for a few days. You are now moving away from the immediate. You don't need to be as immediate with them. Number 2, is they are incredibly concerned with justice and fairness. It's not fair is one of the things we hear from teenagers. Okay, starting as 7th, 6th, 7th, 8th grade, we hear, it's not fair, it's not fair. So they really want fairness and justice. What's right and wrong for them is whether it's understood as fair and just.
Their sense of fairness is different than ours.
Ah, okay, so let's address that, okay? Whether the action, so what is right or wrong? Whether the action fits a code of justice. What makes something fair? This is where we come back to making sure that our things that we do make rational sense. Because if it makes rational sense, if the consequence follows rationally from the action, it's almost impossible for a child to make an argument against it. Let me give you an example. Grades 9 to 12, turn the page, we're on the last page. Here is the construct that you set for your children. As part of the family, we each have our obligations. We all have obligations in a family. We live under the same roof. Therefore, if you want us to fulfill our obligations as parents, you have to fulfill yours as a child. Can we agree on that as a construct? And you put that. It's very hard to argue with that concept, right? We all live under this roof. We all have stuff we have to do. Now, if you want us to cook dinner for you, you've got to chip in and set the table. And in fact, if you refuse to set the table, then you're really not welcome to join us for dinner. Why? It follows from the construct. You've got to do your part and we'll do ours. If you want money to go out with your friends, you have to help out around the house. We all do that differently with chores or with allowance or just with gifts. But I tell parents all the time that you are all obligated for 2 things and 2 things only. You must give room and board. You must have a roof for your child to sleep under. And you must have food in the refrigerator. Everything else is bonus. The foods that they like, that's bonus. Money to go out with friends is bonus. Cleaning up, making their bed for them, that's a huge bonus. Okay? If they want to get stuff from you, they have to give because we're all part of the family. The construct for the second one. You are responsible for yourself, but if you can't handle it, I as my parent have to step in and help you. That's my obligation. So, you stayed out past our curfew, you don't get the keys tomorrow night to the car, right? You have to show the responsibility. You get back in time because that's what safe is, and that means that you're getting enough sleep so that I know that you're awake enough to drive the car tomorrow, right? But if you don't, I will take the keys from you, And for the, any of you who have an older teenager who says, but my kid won't give me the keys and I'll have to fight with them, I tell you to go to the store and buy the club. Wait till they get up the next morning and try to open the car and the club is on and they can't start it. We can do all sorts of things as parents. You said you were finished studying and then you got a D on a test. We need to quiz you next time before when you do your homework. So again, that follows the construct. You're responsible for yourself, but I will step in and help you if I need to. So what you do there is, it doesn't have to be as immediate, but it does, and it's crucial that it follow, I'm wrapping it up, it follow the concept that it be rational. And it is much more important with the older adolescents that your consequences follow a rational, fair idea than with the younger kids. With the younger kids, it's much more about, here's what I'm doing because I said so. But we don't have to do that with the older kids. We could do this for another hour and a half, but we're going to go on to the next one.
Ladies and gentlemen, first of all, I want to thank Dr. Bailey for his presentation.